My name is Liz Moore, and I'm the author of four published novels, and a fifth is on the way. It's called The God of the Woods, and I also teach at Temple University, and I live in Philadelphia.
In Liz Moore's new novel, The God of the Woods, a teenager named Barbara goes missing at the summer camp owned by her family. A situation made stranger by the fact that her brother also went missing in the same area 14 years prior. The God of the Woods is a mystery, but it's also a study on classism and complicated familial bonds. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Liz Moore. Okay, so this is such a smart, layered, literary thriller, but at its base, it's still a thriller with mysteries to chase throughout. Can you give our listeners a description of The God of the Woods so I know exactly how much we're sharing?
Sure. Yeah, The God of the Woods is the story of a wealthy dynastic American family who lives in Albany, New York, and has made a summer home in the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York. The story primarily takes place in 1975 when this family sends their own daughter, Barbara Van Laar, who's 13 years old, to the summer camp on the grounds of this big, fabulous estate that they've built in the wilderness. And Barbara very quickly goes missing from her bunk. But the catch is that 14 years earlier, another child of the Van Laars went missing on the same grounds. And so everybody is wondering, did the same force cause both children to go missing? Was it somebody in the family? Was it somebody in the local community? Was it a different force altogether? Or are these two disappearances unrelated? And that's the story of the God of the Woods.
So I want to talk about the title, The God of the Woods, because we learn fairly early in the book the meaning behind the title. Well, I'm sure there are probably layered meanings, but I'm talking about the most obvious. From the origin of the word panic. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, The God of the Woods is a title that came kind of late to me. And anytime I'm choosing a title, I like to choose one that has multiple meanings throughout that can resonate throughout the book. So I came upon it when I was researching the history of the term wood panic, which is what happens when somebody gets lost, finds themselves disoriented in the woods, and then starts to sort of turn in circles, increasing their disorientation and sometimes walking in the wrong direction for a long time. And I looked up where the word panic itself came from, and it turns out that it comes from the Roman god Pan, who is the god of the woods, among other things. And it was thought that it was Pan, who was kind of a trickster, who would disorient people, confuse them intentionally, and cause them to panic and get themselves further lost. And then I started thinking about all the ways that that could resonate with other things in the book. The phrase itself, the God of the Woods, could relate, in fact, to the family, the Van Laars, who I think, especially the patriarch of the family, thinks of himself as this kind of God of his woods, God of his domain. And then there's a serial killer wandering around in the background of this story. And I will say he lends to the atmosphere of the book as much as the plot. I was really interested in the way that at summer camp, ghost stories are told. And this particular serial killer is a ghost story that the kids tell. And he too could be seen as a god of the woods wandering around in the background. And so, yeah, I liked all the different meanings that it could have.
Now, I'm going to ask a question about setting the story in this time period. And I refer to Peter III. And so we probably should say for our listeners that the Van Laar family, they have a succession of Peters and they just call them Peter I, Peter II, Peter III, and Bear. Bear is Peter IV. So talk to me about this setting. It's, the 1950s and 60s and 70s. And a couple of things stood out for me. Like when Alice and Peter III were being called in to discuss Barbara by the head of her school, and we have this thought about the woman from the school from Alice. She was the first person Alice had ever met who requested the honorific Ms. And then later there was talk about, a son being necessary to pass things down to or to run the business. And these seem to be reflections of the time. Why was this time the best choice for this story?
I liked the 1970s atmosphere. A lot of the story grew out of my personal experiences in the Adirondacks. So I was born later. I was born in the early 80s, but my maternal ancestors lived in the Adirondacks for about a century, from the early 1800s to the early 1900s. And then subsequent generations settled just south of the Adirondacks, which is where my mother was raised. We still go to the Adirondacks frequently, but a lot of my family, sort of like ancestral memories, stories that get passed down to me, came out of my mother's generation, 1950s to 1970s, when she was a young person. And I was very interested in the ways that, I mean, we still have a long way to go in terms of achieving equality or parity for women, but the inequality between men and women was even more pronounced in those days. And I wanted to examine the way that women were disempowered across all classes. So Alice Van Laar, who you referenced, is the mother of the two missing children. And she's a terrible character in some ways. She treats her staff very badly, for example, but I think she never really had the opportunity to become a fully fledged human because she was married off at 17 in what amounted to an arranged marriage. She believes her value is in the way she looks, and she's really emotionally stunted by that. And she is in deep mourning after her son disappeared, and she's never really recovered from that loss. And then all the way down to a camp counselor who her sexuality is complicated. So, as a woman who does not appear straight to the community, she is hindered by what the community says about her in certain ways. And then there's, Judy, this character in law enforcement, who's a member of the first class of female state troopers to graduate in the country. And she faces a lot of discrimination or just kind of like dubiousness on the part of her colleagues because she's a woman. So I guess placing the novel from the 1950s to the 1970s allowed me to explore that a lot more than I might otherwise have been able to.
I don't have a question for this, but I would like for you to talk about a section that was, for me, one of the most powerful of the book. And we know that Peter Four, who is called Bear, disappears into the woods when he was 8 years old. And this is how his mother Alice reacted. Over and over again, she wailed his name, Bear, Bear. And the name itself became a chant or an incantation, assumed all of its many meanings at once. Abide. Endure, sustain, accept, convey, bring forth, give birth to.
I remember writing that passage. I am a kind of a nerd geek, a word geek, a word nerd. I don't know what I was trying to say, all of those things. As you can tell by the fact that I Googled the etymology of the word panic to come up with Pam. I do that sometimes with words. And Barbara's name is actually explored in the book as well. I named her Barbara because it signifies a kind of like wildness or untamedness. There's also a game in the book that I reference called Dictionary, which some people know as Balderdash, which the family plays. And my own family played that as I was growing up, and we still do. And yeah, wordplay is, I guess, important to me, as is naming my characters very carefully to reflect some aspect of their personality as best I can.
We hear many voices throughout the book, but we are interpreting what all are saying through like specific lenses. We know what Louise sees and hears, or Tracy, Alice, Jacob, Carl, Judy, Victor, and Barbara. How do you determine whose turn it is to speak and who gets to share that section of the story?
Yeah, this is a real ensemble piece. You do get multiple close third person perspectives. It's pretty instinctive. When I move from chapter to chapter, I just have to figure out where we are in the story and who would do the best job of telling that portion of the story in such a way that it does not, that it sustains whatever narrative tension that I've created. So what was helpful about having a cast of characters who were not in law enforcement in this book is that they were limited by only what they could perceive in front of them or by their knowledge they had accumulated over the course of their day or their lives. At a certain point, though, so I didn't actually intend to include a law enforcement character in this novel, which is why Judy, the nation's first state trooper who makes an entrance, doesn't make an entrance until maybe a third of the way through the novel, slightly later than everybody else. And that's really because at a certain point I realized that it was necessary to have somebody who would have access to historical records, to police records. But then, even though she entered by necessity, she ended up becoming one of my favorite characters to write. So some of it, yeah, to answer your question, I think it's like certainly a matter of feel, but also a matter of practicality. In certain moments, somebody, one of my characters, it's almost like chess pieces. Like you have to play your knight now because only the knight can move this way. Or you have to play your queen now because you really need a powerful character to come out and tell us what's going on. And then the king is like the characters you don't expect to talk, but they do at a certain point, and that can be powerful too.
The woods, the landscape throughout the book, it almost becomes a character in and of itself. The name of the house on the preserve is Self-Reliance. The main house and the camp are nods to Ralph Waldo Emerson. So could you talk about that?
Yeah. I wanted to call the book Self-Reliance for a long time, but I think there was some concern that people would misconceive it as like a self-help book, or just seeing the title of it would make people think it was nonfiction. Self-Reliance was an essay published by Ralph Waldo Emerson, and the Van Lars adopted the term self-reliance as sort of like their family motto. They have made it the quality to which they believe they should most aspire. But the irony is that they haven't noticed that they are not at all self-reliant. They've really built the house and the camp and the grounds and the preserve on the backs of the working class people in a nearby town and all the people who serve them in various ways. The characters who do evince the quality of self-reliance do so in such a way that the Van Lars don't even notice. For example, their own daughter, Barbara, I think has the quality of self-reliance, but it's in a way that's very displeasing to her family because it violates the code of behavior that they believe a young woman should operate by.
There was a part in the book where one of the characters didn't read Emerson, but instead was reading Thoreau. And it was Louise, who was a camp counselor, and she was at TJ's home, and she picked up this book. And this is a quote from your book. She read Walden out of sheer boredom and found herself annoyed by Thoreau, his self-regard, his tone of superiority, the way he doled out advice so obvious as to be insulting. Here was a rich person playing, thought Louise. There were poor people far more resourceful and self-sufficient than he was. They just had the grace and self-awareness not to brag about it. And there seemed to be a through line, this palpable tension between the Van Laar family and the community. Talk to me about this disconnect between the haves and the have-nots.
I remember feeling Walden and having some of the same thoughts. Like there were at that time certainly subsistence farmers or poor people who were surviving off the land, but just didn't have the time to stop and write a book about what they were doing. Much as I love some of the writing of the Transcendentalists, I always think that when I read, especially Walden. And so, yeah, the disconnect between rich people playing at survival. The point of Camp Emerson is to teach the children of the wealthy how to survive in the wilderness. And people who really do have to survive off the land out of necessity became, I think I tried to draw that distinction out more and more in with each draft that I wrote. This serial killer character hovering in the background of the novel is based on a real serial killer named Robert Garrow, who was active in the Adirondacks in the 1970s and was incarcerated not once but twice because he escaped the first time. So he's very much like Jacob Sluder, the fictional serial killer in the book. And one of the things that really haunted my imagination as a kid about Robert Garrow is that one of the reasons he so successfully evaded the police each time is because he had this deep knowledge of woodcraft and could live off the land. And he would, use people's empty summer homes to hide. And I think there's just something so freaky and scary about that. Even though he was dead by the time I was born, my family still told stories about him because both of my parents remembered a time when he was on the loose and active when they were in the Adirondacks. And that really implanted itself in my psyche. And I think it lent itself to the atmosphere of this book very well.
So we've talked about a lot. Is there anything that you want to talk about that I haven't asked?
I'd love to talk about the work of Anne LaBastille, which she was another source of inspiration for this novel. She wrote a book called Woodswoman, and then she wrote several more, which were memoirs of her time living a pretty solitary life in the Adirondacks. And I read them and just loved them for the beauty of their writing, the way they conjured the atmosphere of the Adirondacks. I think more people should read her work. I think she's a almost, oh God, I'm going to get hate mail for this. I think she's like a better version of the Transcendentalists, or somebody who really was living a real life and narrating all the struggles that she faced, becoming who she ultimately became, which was someone who was very, very self-sufficient for many years in the wilderness, not just for a year or a season.
Well, the book is The God of the Woods. Liz Moore, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
That was Liz Moore, author of the book The God of the Woods, which was published by Riverhead Books. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevenson and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.